Hello, everyone, and welcome to The Hidden Lives of Writers. I'm Fiona Snickers, and I'm joined by my co-host, Gail Schimmel.
Hello, Fiona.
Hi, Gail. How has your writing week been?
It's been so interesting, Fiona, because I'm struggling with writing at the moment. I'm struggling with the making time, all the advice I give myself, sit down, put the writing first, do your 500 words, blah, blah, blah. And at the time of recording, we had a public holiday this week.
Mm-hmm.
And on the public holiday, I said to myself, okay, this is your chance. You are not going to do any of your day job work on the public holiday. You are going to live your fantasy life.
Mm-hmm.
I was going to walk first thing in the morning. That part fell away because our fantasies are never sustainable in reality. But I did manage to get up, do a few morning things, and then at 8:30, I sat down to write. I wrote until 9:30. I wrote 1,600 words. It flowed.
In one hour.
Wow. It just flowed. I am in that lucky thing that I'm in a place where I knew what needed to happen. I knew where I was in the book. I knew exactly what I was writing. I had a plan for the writing session. But it was just the most magnificent experience. And then 9:30... I've written so much, and now in my imaginary life where I don't have to do anything else on any other day, I can get on with whatever I want to. Could have worked on another project, could have done no more work for the day, you know. And it was just that tantalizing taste of what life as a full-time writer would be like.
Mm-hmm.
But would I really do it as a full-time writer? Could I sustain that level of writing every day? I don't know. And let me be honest, the energy ended after that day because it's not like I sat down the next morning like I should have and wrote the next 500 words like I should have. I didn't. I caught up all those emails that I hadn't done and panicked about the work I should maybe have done on the public holiday and all that kind of thing. But it just was, I've still got it. And you, Fiona?
Well, I can also talk about the public holiday, and that is what I want to talk about, because I woke up on that public holiday thinking, I want to write, but first I just need to get a few things out of the way. So, housework, podcast admin, emails, academic work, just get these, I'll just quickly get them out of the way, and then I'll have a clear mind and I'll be able to sit down peacefully with a cup of tea and I'll be able to write. And the day ticked past and there was always something left to do. A child needs that done. My husband needs that done. There are groceries to be ordered. There's supper to be cooked. It never ended. And the whole day went past with me not having written a single thing. And all I'd kind of got done was a few frittery bits of this and that, which I would probably have got done anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And I should have remembered that writing does not wait for you to get everything else cleared out of the way first. You make the time for it, you ring fence that time, and you keep it kind of sacred, if I can use that word.
And you give it the good energy.
Yes.
Not the leftover energy, which is my daily
remembered.
Mistake. My daily mistake is I give everything else the good energy, and then I think there'll be some mediocre energy left over, and in fact, there's no energy left over. You know, it sounds like we learned the same lesson in very different ways. And Fiona, in all the other things you've been doing to put off writing, has watching or reading anything in particular stood out?
Yes, I'm watching quite an interesting show at the moment. I think it's on Netflix. It's called Black Rabbit, and apparently it's loosely based on a true story of a bar restaurant in Manhattan that was known for some shady happenings going on there. And this is a sort of fictionalized version of that, and it's very good. It is a true quality production. Everything about it is really, really good. And I'm having a hard time really caring about the main characters because they are both quite bad people who are doing quite bad things. And I know some people have really struggled with this show because they just think, oh, these are terrible people. Why should I care what happens to them? I've got that a little bit, but the show's also trying to humanize them and explain via their childhood and the rest of their lives and their circumstances, why they are like this. And they're kind of getting into a spiral of worse and worse things happening. It's quite stressful to watch. But it's just interesting to me, when there's nobody to root for, what keeps you going in a narrative?
Very interesting question. Very.
What about you, Gail? What have you been consuming?
Well, I'm also watching TV, and it's not the least bit stressful. I actually thought that you had recommended this series, but it turns out you tell me you didn't recommend it. I'm watching a show called Murderbot.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Apple TV had told me I might want to watch Murderbot. And I had thought Apple TV really doesn't understand me at all if it thinks I want to watch this. Absolutely, something called Murderbot is so not my scene. And then somebody, who knows who, because I thought it was you, said, no, no, actually, it's excellent. You should watch it. And I have. And it is the maddest, quirkiest, most unusual piece of TV that should just not be called Murderbot because it puts people off.
Yes.
It is about a bot. It's about this security unit who is on a planet, and I'm going to say it and people are going to go, oh God, why would I want to watch that? But it's just, he's on a planet. His job is to protect people who hire him, to protect them while they're on that planet. There's a whole political thing going on about planetary politics where he works for a kind of corporate set of planets, and most of the characters are from a free planet, come to explore this more corporate planet for financial reasons. They have to have him. They don't want him. On his on their planet, they're not really comfortable with enslaved bots. But what they don't know is that he has overridden his governor system and does not have to obey them. Mm-hmm. And we hear his inner dialogue the whole time, and his inner dialogue is hilarious. He hates the humans. He can't bear them. They're a bunch of hippies. He doesn't understand them at all. And he's addicted to rubbish science fiction TV shows. So you go into his mind and you see the rubbish science fiction TV show. All his information about life comes from rubbish science fiction TV shows. It is just so different. And what I've realized I'm loving about it, and it's a thing I keep coming back to, that quirkiness. I love a quirky concept. And I'm so jealous that my brain has never had a quirky concept. And I want one. That's what I want for Christmas, please, Fiona. A quirky concept.
Well, somebody who writes quirky, interesting, truly offbeat and fascinating fiction is our guest today. Our guest today is Anna Stroud. Anna is the author of the novel Who Looks Inside, as well as short stories. Who Looks Inside is nominated for the Sunday Times Fiction Prize. It is shortlisted for the UJ Debut Prize, and it won the NIHSS Best Emerging Fiction Author Award. Anna, congratulations. The book is doing fantastically well, and we're so excited to have you in the studio today. Hi, and welcome.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Anna, what has your writing week looked like on the back of all those prizes, nominations? What is the writing week of a prize-winning, prize-nominated writer look like?
Oh, gosh. I am the queen of procrastination. I have this thing where I wake up at 5 every Monday morning to write. And often what happens is I wake up and then I go back to bed. That happened this week. So I woke up. I looked at my laptop and I thought, not today. And I just kept sleeping. So that has been my week. I have not done that.
Every morning you've looked at the laptop and gone back to sleep, or once you've missed Monday.
Once you miss Monday, yeah.
There's no point.
Yeah, it's been downhill from there. I also have a day job though. And it's been, September is a hectic month in corporate comms. So yeah, I struggle to, what's the word? Compartmentalize.
Okay.
So if I'm working on one thing, that is what I'm working on. But I am working on a novel.
Okay. Well, tell us what a good week would look like when you've managed to, you wake up at 5, the laptop doesn't scare you off and you start writing. What does a good week look like in terms of writing?
So I had a good week last week. Got up at 5, made my coffee, and I wrote for 3 to 4 hours straight. And then I went back into the house and said hello to my husband and my dogs. I have an outside office where I work and I need silence. I need my dogs not to bark and I need my husband not to bark. And I need lots of coffee, liters and liters full. So if I do that, then by 11 o'clock, I would have had a good writing day. And then I spent the rest of the day either working on things that will give me money or reading books or, yeah, as the day goes.
And is that only on a Monday or is that every morning when you're having a good week?
Monday is my good day for writing, but I do try. Amy Heidenreich says, touch your manuscript every day. Mm-hmm. So I do try to do a little bit every day, but it won't be that flow that I get on a Monday. It will be going back and trying to figure out who the killer is. Oh, I'm busy writing a paddle, cozy murder mystery.
Interesting. Yeah. Okay.
And I'm about 22,000 words in, which is almost halfway. And it is hard. Writing murder is hard. It is so hard. I don't know how you do it. How do you keep things straight? So that's the first draft is almost done.
So on that Monday, when it's going well, how many words, like how do you measure that it's going well? Do you do a word count? Is it just that you sat there for all those hours? How do you measure your performance on a Monday?
It's very intuitive. If I feel good, then I feel I had a good day. If I managed to keep the storyline straight and I didn't accidentally kill someone off the murder weapon at the moment is a string. And then I realized that there are no strings in paddle. A paddle racket doesn't have string. So then I had to go back and rework that. And after that, that was a good day when I kept myself from failing.
So we've spoken to other cozy mystery writers. And for example, we had Tom Eaton who said he sat down to write his cozy mystery, he chose not to read any others. He was not familiar with the genre at all, which tripped him up in some ways, but also freed him in others to experiment and try new things and not fall in with all the tropes. And then there are other people who really familiarize themselves and bed into the genre and get to know all the tropes. Which one are you? How have you prepared to write this mystery?
Oh, I'm an embedder all the way. Mm-hmm. I read all of it. Karen Slaughter isn't really cozy.
No, not at all. not at all cozy.
Not cozy, but I've been reading so many of her books just to try and, you know, understand how to write the murder part. Okay. And the cozy part, I think, is because I'm a little squeamish. So you know, the death will happen off page or I don't know. I think I feel cozy when I write it. I have my blanket around me.
It's reminding me of my famous Amy Heidenreich once recommended a book to me and said, it's cozy. And I read it and it was not the least bit cozy. It was petrifying. And I went back and I said, Amy, what were you talking about? She said, there was a jacket potato in it. that's not the definition of cozy.
Well, mine has a dog.
Okay.
And that's cozy. Dogs are cozy.
The paddle setting is pretty cozy because having a sort of niche hobby interest setting is quite a cozy trope.
Anna, tell us a little bit about how you came to be a writer. Going back to, you've got a day job that involves writing. From what I've read, you are one of those people who's always wanted to be a writer. So tell us a bit of your backstory.
So yes, I've always wanted to be a writer ever since I was teeny tiny. I learned to read at around 5, 6, and I loved books. I loved books and I loved plagiarizing them. So I would write these fairy tales in my hardcover book and just, you know, almost verbatim rewrite them and put my name on it, which isn't how I write now.
to be clear.
I always wanted to be a writer. And I think also when you show an aptitude for languages, you know, your teachers, my English teachers and my Afrikaans teachers, they were very encouraging from an early age, said you should write. And so I went and studied journalism because I thought that would be a, you know, good stepping stone into becoming a writer. But what I've always wanted to do was write books. Okay. And then after studying journalism, I realized that I don't like talking to people that much. I'm very polite. I don't like asking people about their life. Well, it's different when it's, you know, when I worked for Books Live for Sunday Times, that was different because you're talking to authors and you're asking them about their stuff. I could never work on Carte Blanche. I could never confront, you know, politicians and be like, what happened to the money? You know, that's my alter ego, maybe. So I realized quickly that I was too much of an introvert. So I pivoted more towards lifestyle writing and then corporate copywriting.
And Who Looks Inside was written as part of an MA in creative writing. Is that right?
Yes. So I needed to give myself permission to write, and the best way to do that was to pay for it. So I enrolled in an MA at the University of Pretoria, and then COVID hit. So I had these wild fantasies of driving to Pretoria, going to the library, sitting there for hours and writing, and that didn't happen. Everything happened online. But Professor David Madali was my supervisor, and he guided me, and he lives nearby as well, near me. So that was good. That was like a solid 2 years of writing and figuring out what I want to say.
And in a way, a perfect time to do a master's degree in writing during COVID. In a way, it must have been a bit of a blessing.
No, yes. I mean, COVID was terrible, and it's terrible what it did to the economy. But for me, creatively, it was a good time. I mean, I would wake up, do some yoga, then write a little, play with my dog. I mean, it was cozy. My book's not cozy, but that was cozy.
I think we all have to be allowed to say the parts of COVID we enjoyed. I think it's got to be accepted that there were good parts.
Yeah, you feel guilty, right? Yeah. Because, you know, economy and businesses and things.
And people dying.
Yeah, oh yeah, that too. but for just being at home and being able to write at home. And also it's transformed the way we work. I used to go to offices. Now I can work from home and I'm more productive and I get more things done.
I'm interested in that, and I'm interested in that you said, and I know this is, I'm going down a little rabbit hole, but you said that September is a very busy month for corporate comms, and I'm trying to figure out why that would be. Can you explain that to us, first of all, and then tell us why you like writing from home and not from an office?
After winter, there's a new energy.
Okay.
Right? And then we have more products coming out, okay, and just more things happening. So I always feel like I have more work after winter. Okay. It could also be me that during winter I don't accept as much work because I want to nap.
Maybe it's you who's got more energy.
Yeah, who needs money in winter, right? but September, spring, October, it's always a very busy time for me.
And then the office versus home, what is it about home that makes working from home easier for you?
Oh, wow. Well, you don't have to drive anywhere, right? So that's almost 1.5 hours that you can spend going for a run or playing with your dogs or, you know, playing on your phone, showering. So that's great. And I have a good setup at home. I have my laptop and my second screen and a big table, and I have good internet. I don't have to go around finding a plug. It's all these logistics, these little things that irritate me and then add up and make your work day. Also, there are no other people in my house. No one to bother me.
Okay.
Because in offices, people always want to talk to me. I don't know why.
So let's go back to the MA and the process of having a supervisor. writing used to be a very solitary occupation. You wrote your whole manuscript and then sent it out to be rejected multiple times. And if you're lucky, one person would accept it. Now, I would imagine you are submitting bits of writing and getting feedback all the time and being guided every step of the way. And it's becoming much more common. Many more of our contemporary writers are coming out of these MA, MFA, PhD creative writing programs all over the world. So it's clearly a thing now. Can you talk us through that? What benefit did you feel from it? How did the process shape the book? Would you do it again?
Oh, I would definitely do it again. I think when you're a bit insecure and you don't know if you're a good writer, having a supervisor helps because they can guide you through the process. A lot of what Professor Madali had to do was encourage me not to quit. Because about, you know, the first weekend, I said to my husband, I can't do this. This is crazy. What the heck? And he went, you know, you paid for it. Just do it. So Madali let me set the pace. So, I would send him chapters after when I felt ready. Mm-hmm. And then he would give me feedback. And a lot of his feedback showed me, for example, it would be once, and because my book is set in different continents, right? Getting the seasons right was so difficult. Like in one moment, it's spring, then it's autumn, then she's wearing a jacket, then she's wearing a t-shirt. So keeping those threads in my head, it was really good to have him point out to me, why is she now in a jacket? Now she's, you know, in summer. So, you know, all those little details that help, but also just in the general sense, it helps to have someone giving you feedback and showing you different ways of doing things.
And for our listeners who might be thinking of doing an MA in creative fiction, how is the course structured? Do you just have to produce a book, or is there also a theoretical component?
So yes, so for the University of Pretoria course, you do a mini dissertation and it is linked to your book. So mine was on childhood trauma in literature. So I examined The Yearning by Mohale Mashiko and I used different theories to analyze the book. It was like a textual analysis.
How did analyzing someone else's book on a sort of textual analysis basis inform your own writing, because your book also has to do with childhood trauma and abuse? So did the two feed into each other?
Absolutely. I wanted to understand. I mean, I read a lot of true crime. I watch a lot of true crime, lots of Criminal Minds. And I wanted to understand specifically how childhood trauma manifests in an adult protagonist, in an African, South African setting, you know? So not the US version or the UK, not the European version, we are here in South Africa, this is what we go through, that kind of feeling. And a lot of the things I read had to do with the fact that, you know, the traditional definition of trauma is an event that disrupts your life. So it presupposes a before and an after, right? But in a South African context, a lot of abuse is from the start. You know, you're born and there's abuse. So it's not so much a disruption as it's insidious trauma. It's part of your life always. So how does that manifest and appear and affect your daily life? And I don't know if you've read The Yearning, but it is a beautiful book.
Yeah.
And it grapples with it, you know, very beautifully. So I did take a lot of, what's the word? I did lean on it a lot in writing the manuscript. So I wrote the manuscript first, and then I did the mini dissertation, and then I went back to the manuscript. And so all the reading I did kind of informed the final story that came out.
And you've told us that now you're quite consciously writing a cozy mystery, but when you were writing Who Looks Inside, did you have a genre in mind, and how do you define it genre-wise now?
Oh, I had no genre in mind. And I didn't really even think it would get published. It was a thought experiment. It was fun. It was depressing, you know. It was the best of days. It was the worst of days. It was a time. I was also getting therapy at the time. So that was very, that was a mess. So I am, and also the book as it is now isn't the final manuscript that I submitted for my dissertation. Okay. There were more edits after that. As you say, you submit it, it gets rejected, you cry, you rewrite some things. So yeah.
And the book that was published, where does that sit for you? Genre, if someone forces you to say what type of book was that, can you do that?
I guess literary fiction.
Okay.
And it is the kind of fiction that I read, but I read a lot of, I don't want to say magical realism, but magical realism. And I like the idea of different timelines and different possibilities and universes and things like that. So if I have to categorize it, literary fiction.
With a touch of magic realism.
Yes.
Well, we'll throw that in.
With a touch of madness.
Do you get asked about how autobiographical this book is and whether any of your life fed into it? How much are people in your life seeing themselves in the book or asking you questions about that? And how do you respond to those kinds of questions?
I do get that asked a lot. And I think when you write, you know, parts of yourself will go into the story. For example, there's one part where the father's just died and this woman comes and she's her friend's caretaker or nanny. And so my friend from primary school messaged me and he was like, "Is this Selma?" So that was funny. So
was it Selma?
No, it's fiction, guys. It's fiction, which is what I told him. there are some real things and there are things that I fictionalized. So it's not a straightforward in terms of the plot and the narrative. That is imagined. But there are, you know, places and events and things that are real.
Let's talk about the places because I understand. I couldn't from my research tell, did you live in Korea or did you just travel there?
I lived in Korea. So I lived in Daegu for about 3 years. That's a smaller city between Seoul and Busan. So on the different sides. And that was amazing. It was one of the, I was straight out of university. I had so much student debt. And Teach Korea came to Rhodes and they said, you know, this is a good way to make some money, see the world. And that is what we did. So my husband, well, my boyfriend at the time, Sean, him and I went over together and paid off our student loans. Yeah, it was a good time.
And informed your writing.
Yes, absolutely. I actually started writing some of it in Korea. So there are bits where, for example, where she's in the train and she's running away from someone and she falls in a puddle and she sees, you know, there's this man in the puddle. That I wrote in Korea while I was, I had a blog.
Okay.
I don't know if it still exists, but it was on a blog at some point.
Remember how we used to think that blogs would stay there forever? And now they've disappeared.
I don't even know my passwords.
So another theme that we've been picking up interviewing different authors lately is this idea of therapy and writing. And we have authors who say to us, "I wrote the book and that was my therapy. Felt much better after that." And then we've had other writers who say, "I wrote the book, realized I needed therapy and went and got therapy. It stirred everything up and didn't resolve anything and I needed therapy to sort it out." And we've had authors who are sort of even incorporating the therapy into the narrative, writing about someone who's in therapy, telling their story, you know, and you get these sort of meta layers of putting your story for the therapist, then putting it in fictionalized form to a fictional therapist. It's very interesting. Where do you fall on that? Did therapy and writing happen simultaneously, and did they feed into each other at all?
I was doing therapy before I started writing. I wouldn't say the writing was therapeutic. I wouldn't say that it, you know, achieves the same thing that a therapist can do. But it does force you to be honest with yourself and to confront things and to think about things.
I've also noticed one of the links, because I was just thinking as Fiona asked that question, and I was thinking my therapist has turned a little bit into a writing coach. She goes, did you write since I saw you last? Because writing makes me happy. And I'm interested, does writing do that for you?
Oh, yes. Yes. Writing does. Writing makes me happy in the same way that running makes me happy. It takes me a long time to get to do it. But then when I do it, I feel so amazing. And I feel, why did I take so long? Why haven't I run in 2 weeks? I feel amazing. Like I ran this morning. I feel amazing. And yesterday I felt awful. And it's the same with writing. When I write for, you know, continuously for 2-3 hours, I feel so amazing afterwards, whether the writing was any good or not. It's the act of writing. And before I used to write by hand, but I've now realized that it takes too long. So now I have a little laptop that I call Gandalf, and it doesn't connect to the internet. It's a glorified typewriter. I just sit and tap away.
And is that a separate device to what you do your day job on?
Yes, yes. This one has all its keys.
This is so interesting.
This is so interesting. Yeah. Why is it a separate device? Talk us through this whole thing.
Really? I thought it was, I don't know, weird. So I have my big laptop that I work on, but that laptop only has work connotations for me. So when I open it, I am in work mode. I am going to edit. I am going to make money. That is all I can think of. And I'm thinking of all the emails that are waiting for me. It's very distracting. And also with a work laptop, there are notifications. So I decided at the start of this year or last year that I was going to get myself a very cheap little secondhand refurbished laptop that I bought at Tech Market, and I took off all the software. There's no, you know, it doesn't update. It doesn't annoy me. Microsoft doesn't try to nudge me to do things. It's just, there's a Word document, an old one, and that's it.
How are you backing it up?
I have a USB.
Okay. Promise me you're backing it up. I've had a laptop stolen with half a novel on it.
Really? I've dreamt that it got stolen. So, yeah, I have a USB. It's probably not big enough, but yeah.
Where's your phone while you're working on Gandalf? Mm. Is your phone in the room with you?
Oh, no. My phone is in the house.
Oh, really? So there are no distractions. Yes. The dogs are quiet. The husband's quiet. The notifications are quiet. It's just you and this essentially word processor.
And the birds outside chirping.
Wow.
No,
This is revolutionary.
I get so easily distracted. If there's a notification, then I start to stress about work or
And does it
else.
Not make you anxious that maybe that phone's beeping and maybe the emails are coming in and you don't know what's going on and the whole world could have ended and you don't know? Does that not make you anxious?
It makes me more anxious to know. And that is why Mondays really set the tone, because if I don't do that on a Monday, then the rest of my week is just a little off, a little fidgety, a little not lacquer.
And can you not say it to yourself, I realize we're circling back to this Monday story, but can you not say it to yourself, it's okay, Anna, you can start on Tuesday?
That is why Amy's advice of touching your manuscript every day, I've started using that more. So even if Monday didn't go well, on a Tuesday I'll open Gandalf, I'll stroke the keys, I might write a sentence and delete it later, but I'm trying to be gentler with myself. Mm. Otherwise it's going to be one and done.
Mm. Let's talk about that. Let's talk about the stress of writing a second book, because I think it is the hardest book to write. And how is that going for you?
Oh, it is hard. It is hard. I've been writing short stories. I read a book on writing based on Kurt Vonnegut's lectures. And one of the things he told his students was to write 20 bad stories. Okay. And that's great because it gives you permission to fail, right? Because mm-hmm. you're not writing good stories, you're writing bad stories. Mm-hmm. So I've been working on my 20 bad stories. And one of the bad stories is in Power.
Wow.
The short story collection curated by Joanne Hitchens. So,
which won a highly commended prize, I think.
Yes, it was highly commended. And that was handwritten. That was one of those early morning handwriting stories that then was shaped into something else. And that is more dystopian fiction. I read widely. I read whatever, you know, Chappie's papers, anything. I'm not married to one particular genre. I like to write what I feel in the moment.
So let's talk about Who Looks Inside, because it is a very interesting and quite challenging book. And the reader cannot passively sit there and just absorb what's going on. The reader has to actively engage with this text and figure it out, and also, in a way, impose their own interpretation on what is going on. Were you consciously doing that? Did you want the reader to get up off their butt, stop being comfortable, and join the party and start doing some work?
I think in a way, yes. But to be honest, I don't think I was writing with a particular reader in mind when I was writing it, because it was for a degree, not necessarily for publication. And I've always liked choose your own adventure books.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And I like the idea of, as I said, different timelines, different universes. People always ask me, but which story is the real story? Mm-hmm. And they're both real. They're both real, and they're both possibilities of an outcome. And I like the idea, and I think people can resonate with it, of going back and fixing things, right? I think that was the impetus for this book, was the yearning, and I think COVID also just brought that out, the yearning to go back and change things and change how you do things. Mm. But you can't go back, and even if you do go back, you won't be the same person going back. So all of that, it is hard, because it's a hard thing to do and to try and imagine. And I think one of my moderators said that he liked that I didn't spoon feed the reader. And so I stuck with that. I did get feedback, initially to change things in that respect. And I said, no, I'm not spoon feeding the reader. The reader can interpret it and also make the meaning, be part of the meaning making. You know, like I like that, those kinds of books where I get to participate and, you know, DIY reading. So yes. Sticking to that.
I love alternate reality books, sliding door moments. And I suppose this year The Names is the leader in that field. Did you come to writing this book with that thing that you like, that kind of story? And also I'd be interested in, have you read one that sticks in your mind? Like, for you, what is the leader in this field of alternate reality type stories?
I remember at university, we read a short story, and for the life of me, I can't remember what it's called, but it's by Borges, and it's about Borges meeting himself on a park bench and talking about how, and that's always boggled my mind. And I also watch a lot of Korean movies, and that kind of alternate universe happens a lot in the movies I watch. But I didn't actually set out to write these two stories. I started writing pretty much the intro, the first few chapters as they are. And then there was this voice in my head saying, hold on, but this isn't the whole truth. And then another voice started speaking. So that second voice kind of came out organically. Okay. And, you know, I was curious and I listened, and the rest of it then unfolded. And then when she goes home, I thought, yo, what now? Oh, wait, there she is again. So then it was that looking through the mirror, through the window, and there's another reality happening. So I didn't plan it. I'm not a planner at all. I just sat and, you know, winged it.
It's a very slippery book. And the moment I started thinking, okay, I've got it now, two alternate realities, I'm like, no, wait. There's more going on here, because – There's the timeline where she stayed in the small Afrikaans rural town, and there's the timeline where she left and went to Korea and formed a different life. Then she goes back for her mother's funeral and meets her alternate self. And that, to me, seems to be almost a third possibility where they actually become kind of aware of each other and aware that they could have chosen different destinies. And then there's also this voice who, while Korean Anna is in the town, keeps tapping at her, knocking at her, and urging her to let something in and to remember something, which seemed to me to be almost like a fourth possibility. So my mind was really getting boggled as I was reading it. Do you have it all straight in your mind? Do you have an idea of what reality is in your mind? I mean, if you were the reader, have you worked it out for yourself?
For me, I didn't have one reality straight. In my mind, they all coexist.
Okay.
Yeah.
So they're all possible alternatives.
Yes. And I didn't try to figure out which one is the one, you know, because they all happened in my brain and I just put it on the paper.
You just made an interesting Freudian slip. Unless I didn't hear you correctly.
Oh, I heard it too.
Yeah.
What did I say?
You said Korean Anna, not Korean Hannah. And I'm interested in that. No, I'm interested in that because the names are very similar. And was that a deliberate, did you consciously or unconsciously find a name that is very similar to your name?
I've always liked the name Hannah because of the palindrome, the H. Actually, I still.
But Anna's a palindrome too.
Yeah, yeah. But I actually stole it from Craig Higginson because one of his books has a Hannah, okay. The girl with the yellow dress. Her name was initially Maggie.
Okay.
Yeah, which she just didn't feel like a Maggie to me, yeah. A Margaret, a Magriet, you know. So then I changed it to Hannah and then realized it sounds a lot like my name.
What I've read about you has mentioned that you love authors and that you live near love books so that you can go to launches. And not every writer has that. Not everybody loves other authors. Like a lot of writers are quite insular. Can you tell us what you've got out of that exposing yourself to authors and that open-minded idea to loving authors that has fed into your writing?
Well, I'm very big on supporting local authors and local content on TV. And I think it comes from an early age. I grew up watching Seven Lawn and Generations and Isidingo and reading, you know, South African books. And I used to work for Books Live, Sunday Times Books Live. And at that time I was living in Edenvale. So I had to drive to Love Books because most of the launches are at Love Books. Mm-hmm. I would drive to Love Books, not have book launch wine. Because I have to drive home. and then when we started looking at places to live, I was adamant I want to live in Melville. I want to be able to go to launches and have the book launch wine and chat to, you know, because you need the wine to be able to talk to the authors.
Of course.
So, so I think working for Ben Williams at Books Live, that started the love for authors and just, and I don't even have to talk to them. You know, I just have to be in their presence and listen to, because I also steal all the writing advice that they share and the little bits, you know, the little nuggets they drop. I pick it up and I put it in my pocket and I keep it for later.
Let's talk about small, isolated, rural Afrikaans towns. How much personal experience do you have of that setting? And do you believe that there's anything about that setting that gives rise to books about childhood trauma?
I don't know about the second part of the question, but so yes, I grew up in a small rural Klein Karoo dorpie, Karlitsdorp, and I went to school in Oudtshoorn, which is around the corner. But I grew up very, no technology, just hills and grondpaaie and barefoot, you know. So I spent a lot of time alone in the trees and walking and just, it was a very, not isolated, but you could see a lot of space around you. There weren't that many people. And I think the landscape itself gives you that. The stories you tell are, they are more ghost stories. And because you have this, I grew up listening to these records with ghost stories on them that, and it was coming from, you know, from the landscape. So there's the Spook van Uniondale, that woman who stands, you know, and these, and Anki Swimmers. Mm-hmm. And these were stories that were just part of my, the fabric of my brain. So I think that, and they're all traumatic, right? I mean, Anki Swimmers kidnaps children, and Die Spook van Uniondale, she died and she can't rest. So I think that, yeah, the stories that I grew up with are very dramatic. So that's what I would end up writing. Big. And I have these dreams, these like cosmic horror dreams, and I, that have nothing to do with me or my life. And I'll wake up and I'll think, what was that? I need to write that down.
And do you write it down and do you use it?
Yes, sometimes. So I have this one recurring dream where I'm in this mansion that's burning down and people are speaking German around me and there's this ginger cat that I need to rescue. So is that a past life?
Is it?
I don't know. But it's a recurring dream. There's episodes. It continues. And then I'm in the street and then the cat is a dog. And I have these dreams where my dog, her name is Raven. She's this little black dog, where she erupts and she flies away. You know, these really, and I really think that growing up in the Karoo with those mountains and that vast landscape, and it's just, it did something to my imagination that, yeah, it's going to take a lot of therapy to figure that out. Or I must just embrace it and write it.
Embrace it and write it. I'm worried we're going to run out of time.
Okay.
And there is a very important thing that we need to talk about.
Oh, right.
Come dine with me.
Yes.
You were on an episode of Come Dine With Me. I want to know, what inspired you to do it? What it was? I want to know everything. Start at the beginning and talk.
Well, it again started at COVID. We were using my father-in-law's DSTV logins, and I just watched all the Come Dine With Me South Africas because they were just playing on repeat all the time. And I said, I want to do that. So when they had a call for contestants, I entered, and it's a wild entry process. You have to first, you know, tell them what you want to make. Then they
really right at the beginning.
Yes, you have to have decided. Well, you have to give them different options.
Okay,
and then there's an interview, and then there are so many questions, and you have to make a video of your house, and then yeah, then there's more interviews, and eventually they tell you, okay, we're coming next week. And at that time, I don't know if you could see it on the show, I was damp proofing my house, so there were all these parts of my wall that just had no, the plaster's been off, gone off, they put all the damp proofing whatever paint on it, and then it had to dry, so my house looked awful. And then I had these three guys, two of whom were quite judgy.
Well, I mean, you open yourself up to some quite hard, and if you'd watched them all, you know that it can turn ugly.
Yes,
some
yes.
It sometimes turns really ugly.
But those are the best episodes.
But how did you put yourself up for that?
I don't know. Because I just told you earlier that I'm yes. shy and introverted.
Yes.
And I don't know. I think you go to a different place in your head and you just do. Because I'm last year I was also part of a community theater. So I do think I've had that urge to be on TV and be in a drama club. Like I was a crocodile in a pantomime and last year. So I do want to be an actress. I'm almost 40. I can still do it.
You can still do it. Mm. Okay. And then. The end of the process, I haven't seen the episode. I don't watch regularly. I watch it when it comes up in my Facebook feed. Did you enjoy the process? You know, would you recommend it again? What?
Oh, I loved it. I loved everything about it. It was very hectic when they said we're coming next week and they start on the Wednesday. So I had to figure out my work schedule. I had to get my husband and my dogs out of the house, you know.
And you had to cook.
And I had to cook. I had to actually cook. And you watch the episode.
And do they have you? You filmed while you cook. They film you the whole time.
They film you the whole time from early in the morning. Everything you do, they film. So you can't pick your nose or swear. You have to be engaged the whole time. Yeah. So that was a lot of fun. And I really liked everyone that was on the episode with me. I've tried to be friends with them, but you know, they also have lives.
So apart from Come Dine With Me, what have you been reading or watching or listening to lately?
So I've been reading a lot of crime type books like Karen Slaughter and Tess Gerritsen, just, you know, trying to get familiar with the how it's done. But then I'm watching Young'uns on Showmax and it's amazing. I love it. I love it so much. It's also, I remember being a teenager and sneaking out to smoke cigarettes and, you know, I had a scholarship and things could have gone really badly. But when you're a teenager, you don't think about the bad things that can happen. But now I'm watching these teenagers and I keep screaming at the TV, don't do that. You're going to lose your scholarship. Stop selling weed. And my husband finds it very amusing because our house is open plan. So he'll be cooking in the kitchen while I'm shouting at these children on the TV. But I've decided I need to learn Zulu. So I'm starting Zulu lessons next week. Just so that I can watch Young'uns and not read the subtitles. But also for other reasons, obviously, you know, it's good to have another language. But yeah, I love Young'uns.
Brilliant.
Brilliant. Well, Anna, we hope everyone checks out Who Looks Inside, which is published by Caravan Press and is on shelves right now. Also, the Power Anthology of short stories, edited and curated by Joanne Hitchens. You have a short story in that, which is great. And we're very much looking forward to the Paddle Cozy Mystery, as well as anything else you bring out in the future. Thank you so much for your time. This has been great.
Thank you for having me. Thank you both.
Thank you, Anna.
Gail, I feel like we have caught Anna at the beginning of what is going to be a very, very interesting career.
I think that's definitely true. And I think it's going to be an interesting and unpredictable career. It's going to be so fascinating to see what she does next. You know, she's got a very quirky way of seeing the world, of thinking. And I don't know where that quirk is going to take us next. It's going to be fascinating to watch.
It certainly is. And what did you take from her?
Lots of things. But what I want to talk about is I was very interested in that Kurt Vonnegut thing about writing 20 bad stories as an exercise. I thought that it appeals to me as an exercise. You know, I'm a great believer in giving yourself permission to write badly. I think when you sit down to write your first novel, I think you need to give yourself permission to write a bad novel first, because sitting down to write a good novel is an overwhelming undertaking.
Yes.
And I think that this, because I've struggled with short stories, I struggle to sit down and write them. I wait for a very good idea. And I really like this idea of write 20 bad stories. I think it's something I want to do quite actively. So that for me was a fun, inspiring piece of advice from her. What about you?
I think we both were fascinated by the idea of her offline laptop called Gandalf. You know, there are apps that do that. There are supposedly apps that shut you off from the internet, shut you down, and don't let any notifications through. And I know writers who've tried that for a while. Mm. But if your phone is in the same room as you, you're just as exposed to outside interference. Mm. But she has actually done the writer's dream. She's in an outside room. Mm. She's on an offline device that she only uses for her creative writing. Her phone is not in the room with her. She is living the dream. She has cracked the code for not being distracted.
It's so brilliant, but so frightening. Like, my stomach clenches at the idea of trying to do it. I honestly, it's so foreign to me, but you're right. She's cracked the code. That is what you have to do if you want to have that silence and that non-distraction. Because my distraction levels these days, I don't know about you, Fiona, but I can be mid-sentence and I will pause to check what's going on Instagram.
Yeah.
Like, this is not an emergency. I do not need to know what's going on Instagram, but mid-sentence.
Yeah.
It's terrible.
It is terrible. And we both said, oh, you know, we would be stressed not knowing what's going on. Mm. And she said, no, knowing what's going on stresses you. Mm. And it's true. It does.
It does. But I also know, saying this and knowing that she's right and knowing that that's what we should do, I also know I'm not going to do it. I really, I'm that badly addicted to distraction that I don't even think I can try. Are you going to try it, Fiona?
I'm going to try very, very hard because distraction is my enemy at the moment. It does make things take much longer than they should. And it really is something that I need to address seriously. And when I get serious about a problem in my life, I can usually fix it or make it better. And this is something that I need to make better.
I'm really looking forward to an update from you next week.
Well, if anybody has tried being completely offline and undistracted, if you have read Who Looks Inside by Anna Stroud, published by Caravan Press, please get in touch with us and let us know. We're on all social media across the board and we'd love to hear from you.
You've been listening to another production from Solid Gold Podcasts.